We're going to finish up asking you with us. Remember we started the first week before we got interrupted by our peppers of Truma. Did anybody do it this week? Anybody buy anything Israeli? Come on. Meyer. You got to go to Meyer's. They have Israeli produce. Usually the peppers in Meyer. Oh, you looked at the peppers?
Yeah. We don't eat peppers.
Then I can't help you. Tell me Meyer. It's peppers, persimmons, and some tomatoes they say you can find. Anyway, before we were so really interrupted by the taking of Truma, we were discussing the many, many different types of prohibitions of prohibited foods, which I did not get to finish. I just briefly want to finish the last two. And these are all sort of topics and headings for us to go back to later on. This is not what we're going to be discussing today, but it's important for us to understand. First one, we're going to see on the, this is page 4 from class 1, as you see. So if you're listening at home, and we hope many people are listening at home when we post this to the web, this is from the first class, associates in the first class, page 4. So on the left-hand side, you'll see there's such a thing as non-Jewish food and non-Jewish bread, called pas akum ubisal akum. People are not aware. This is an absolute halacha derabbanan. Now it turns out, in regarding bread, the Jews, many Jews were more makil, were more lenient, because there came a point and problems about finding bread that was not made by a Jew. Because if you had, let's say, a small town or a small area, I mean, how many bakers could you have in a certain square mileage? It would be very difficult. So the Rambam, this is all from the Rambam in Mishneh Torah. He says, these all rabbinic prohibitions. There are other things that the rabbis prohibited. Even though they're prohibitions, the teacher over there, the prohibitions are not from the Torah. Nonetheless, Gazru Aleihem, the rabbis decreed them kideli hisrachek min hagoyim, in order to distance us from the non-Jews. Ad shelo yisarvu bahem, so that we would not become mixed with them. V'yavo lidei chasnus. And what would come to happen? Chasnus. What is chasnus? Marriage. Wouldn't intermarry. Right? And that the rabbis understood. If you do certain things with the non-Jews, you're going to come to intermarry. Okay? We're going to see. Even in the places you don't have to worry about Yai Nesach, we'll see what that is next. The rabbis prohibited eating their bread, non-Jewish bread, pas akum it's called, or their cooked food. Even if you have no worries about their cooking, meaning that you know 100% the non-Jew cooked it for you, but he cooked it kosher. He's got a separate pot for you, and he's got his own, you know, the dishes set aside, and you know definitively that this is kosher. Still can't eat it if he cooked it for you. Why? It's called the bishul akum, non-Jewish cooking, and it's prohibited. Okay, now we're going to get into interesting discussions, but one could see immediately how this could be a problem. What would be a potential problem?
Well, my mother had a living companion.
Correct. It's a huge, huge issue when you come to live in help. You know, somebody sent me a message, maybe they're listening, I don't know, they didn't ask me this question, they sent me a message that said, Rabbi, I have a problem because I asked my housekeeper, my maid, to put up a pot of rice, and she put up a pot of rice and then put butter in it, and it was a fleshik pot. And so she said, did the pot need to be kashered? Those are all great questions, by the way, which we're going to address. So that had one, but I couldn't tell her. I just didn't feel it was my place to tell her, by the way, the rice was straight anyway, because it's cooked by a non-Jew. Unless she knew, I didn't know, maybe she knew to put turn the fire on, as we're going to see, but that I didn't sound like, I didn't get that impression that was the issue. Matt Prentice is not allowed to turn on the ovens in his own restaurant. That's the rule.
It has a
pilot. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about all the details later on, probably in maybe 10 weeks or so.
Yeah, my but will lit the pilot.
Right. Very good. Nowadays you have a bigger problem.
No pilot light.
So we're going to talk about that. Ketzad? Okay. What does this mean? Lo yista adib b'mesiba shel goyim. You're not allowed to drink in a non-Jewish mesiba as a party. Even if it's cooked wine, remember we're going to talk about dimethine. Yeah, cooked wine, not cooked wine. Osha yeshota mikelev levado, or he's drinking from his own cup. But if most of them are Jews, then it's permitted. So ve'ein shotin shechar shalahem sheosim in hatzmarim, but ve'einim yotzim. You're not allowed to drink non-Jewish booze. Ve'ein asher ala b'malkam yichiraso. Person is Jew is not allowed to go to a non-Jewish bar and have drinks with the guys. Why? Because again, it's from chasnas. Now, is it naive of the rabbis to think that if you go drinking with the non-Jews, you're going to have intermarriage issues? Is that naive?
No.
Not in today's day and age, that's for sure that is true.
If you socialize.
That's right.
Socialize.
That's right. And, you know...
You don't draw it at the bar.
I was talking with a guy last night who does college kiruv. And kids, rightfully so, they don't understand. What's the problem? I mean, you know, they're good people, we're good people. What do we have against non-Jews? I mean, we don't have anything against non-Jews, but we want our children to marry Jews to perpetuate the values of Judaism. And if you go drinking with people, people are nice people, they're wonderful people, you have a great time, sooner or later, before you know it, you have problems, relationship issues that are serious. So the Rabbanim made a gzeira. Also, you're not allowed to eat their meals, even if they cook for you. Why? Because eating with people is a legitimate problem. It's a halachic problem. Let's go next problem. Yayin nesech, a separate problem, on the right-hand side. Non-Jewish wine. Yayin nesech means poured wine. What would the non-Jews pour wine for? Idolatry.
Oh.
Right. In the times of the Gemara especially, and in the times of the Tanakh, when the non-Jews worshipped idolatry, one major form of idolatry was pouring of wine. In fact, the pouring of wine isn't the only is only idolatry. In the Beis Hamikdash, they had pouring of wine, yisuch hayayin, libations for God. They would pour wine on the altar. It was a sign of a sacrifice. It was part of what came with the sacrifices. Yayin, look at Aleph, Rambam, Aleph, Perek, Achadasar, chapter 11. Yayin, shini nasech la'avodah zarah, wine that was poured for avodah zarah. Asur behanaya. Not only are you not allowed to drink it, you're not allowed to benefit from it, which means you couldn't sell it, and you're not allowed to also give it to someone as a gift. And someone who drinks any of it, is lokem min haTorah, gets malchus, gets lashes. Okay? Skip to number 3, Gimel. Okay?
Over that again, you can't give wine.
Yayin nesach. Yayin, not yayin nesach. Wine that you know that was used as a libation. You can't give it away. Yayin agoy, gimel. She'ein anu yodim idi nasech or lo nasech. Let's say the non-Jew has wine. Now, by the way, remember that nowadays wine is produced and then put in bottles and then sold. It wasn't always that way. How was wine sold? So if you ever ask Manny Middleman, I just learned this Yom Kippur, he told me, his father was a wine merchant were you there when he was talking about it? His father was a wine merchant in the town, like on a we lived in Hungary, right over the border from Poland. And how did he buy wine? He said, everybody had their own bottles. Right? You brought your bottle, he had a jug, a big barrel, filled it up, you know, and then you went home. So the wine, it wasn't like, you know, there was one bottle of wine and you knew that this bottle of wine was produced. That the wine was all mixed together. It's all mixed together. So, the hu anikra stam yenam. Stam yenam is wine that you don't know if it was used for avodah zarah purposes, for idolatry or not. Asur b'hana, kemo yayin shenitnasech. Right? It is also asur b'hana. So let's say your boss gives you a bottle of a Moen champagne for the holidays, right? For the holidays. Thank you very much. There's only one problem. Not only can't you drink it, that's stam yenam. Not only that, the rabbis decreed you can't give it to anyone. Why? Because you're benefiting in the giving of a gift. Right. So how do you get rid of it? You can either pour it down the drain, you can demasker it, you can abandon it perhaps.
Can you give it to a charity that doesn't know who gave it?
Oh, maybe.
What do you mean you benefit from it?
When I give you a gift...
Is it a suck up to the box?
No, that's not the point. When I give it to Aviva, if I give Aviva a gift, now Aviva feels good, and she feels like she owes me. So you can't do that, okay? Uh-huh. If you drink it, again, you're not allowed to drink it. Dalit, v'chol yayin shiyiga bo hagoy, any wine that was touched by a non-Jew, hare ze aser. It is prohibited. Shema nasach oto. Maybe he was touching it for that purpose. Anyway, so as we see, I just wanted to point out, now, by the way, everybody knows, we're going to talk about Yayin Nesach as well, and the various questions that arise with Yayin Nesach. There's one way to get wine out of Yayin Nesach. How do you get wine from being Yayin Nesach? From being, you boil it. Any wine that's cooked wine, the rabbi said, cooked wine is cheap wine. So the non-Jews wouldn't use cooked wine for their idolatry. So any wine that's cooked, That's permissible. You don't have to worry. Again, you come up with the same problems about household help. Why? Because let's say you have your household help, your maid's not home, and you keep your wine in your refrigerator. Let's be honest. Are you 100% sure that the hired help had taken a swig no matter what anyway? Can we really be sure? We've all heard horror stories about how, you know, the maid or the whatever had a drinking problem.
They
had problems.
And they take it out.
What?
They clean it.
And how do you know they didn't open it?
No, what I'm saying, but if they're cleaning and if they don't, but they are touching it.
Oh, no, they have to touch the actual wine. They'd have to open it. But you don't know that they did it. So it is, it's interesting. A very generous member of our shul knows that I like wine, so he gave me a bottle of non-mevushal French wine. Mm. And just so you know, non-mevushal wine from France is the finer wine. You know, once had a wine connoisseur come in, and he said that wine that's not cooked is live. It's developing. It's like changing over time. I mean, from what I know of these things. Wine that's mevushal, once you cook it, it's dead. Like all the bacteria or all the female fermentation is gone. All the gone, dead. Do they cook it? No, right, because it continues to ferment over time.
I still have the wine press.
Really? No, there you go. So what if you have non-mevushal wine in your house? I thought about this week, and then I realized, oh, we finished it last week, so it wasn't a problem, because then the non-Jewish helper comes, and she's cleaning out your refrigerator. I don't know if she didn't open it. Honey, no, she didn't touch it. So you'd have to double seal it. One way of doing it is sealing it in such a way where you'd know that it was opened, if it was open. But otherwise, what most people do is,
not have fire help.
They don't, well, that's one. Or?
Buy
mevushal wine. Most people buy mevushal wine, except on Pesach. Because on Pesach, there is an element, there's an idea of having the most ideal wine for the four cups. So people are careful, some people are makbid, are specifically careful to buy non-mevushal wine, and kerem, which is normally always cooked, comes out with like the special size. You'll sometimes see in the announcement book, the 4.2 liter bottle is non-mevushal. You have to know that because very often, especially around Pesach time, people have non-Jewish workers, non-Jewish people in their homes.
I remember
you have to be careful.
Rabbi Weil convinced us to buy non-mevushal. We couldn't stand it.
Why? It's the ketem?
We're not wine connoisseurs.
But
I mean, no, you're supposed to. I don't know.
You bought real wine. You bought the. Oh, okay. That's not for you. Yeah. I would have told you to get the Malaga non-mevushal. You know?
No, they do make that.
Sure, sure. So this comes up sometimes. Sometimes, if you'd ask a kashrus agency, the answer will almost always be no. I want to serve fine wine at my bar mitzvah. Right? And the answer will almost always be no. Because imagine having something that if your non-Jewish guest takes a glass, right, and then he puts it down, it's treif. Right? Would you allow him to bring in his pork and put it down, lest someone should pick it up? What?
I can't believe
you never heard this before, this rule?
Absolutely not.
Sitting in the Rambam, it's an ancient rule from the times of the Talmud. It's a Deed Rabbanan, absolutely.
You never saw anybody normally go to religious and my father and mother and didn't leave me.
Did they? Maybe your father cooked the wine at the end? He boiled it up?
I don't think so.
And he had non-Jewish help in the house?
We sure did.
That's
in
the
maid.
That's very interesting. All right, well.
But the maid didn't touch the wine. I mean,
are you sure?
Pesach time, I think maybe she did. I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. All right, so it had to have been. Then I'm sure your father would boil it. You understand what I'm saying? Because all you do is boil it once, and you're all set. Anyway, those are, but we digress. You put this aside.
So those are the things that people have in all the
Shalom. 100%, absolutely correct. That's why all the wine is mevushal. Look on the side; it's all mevushal wine.
When I was in college, there was a very elegant wedding at Shari Tzedek, and they hired me and five of my friends to just come in and pour the wine.
Right, right. Sometimes, depending on, I'll put it this way, how powerful the balabas is and how much money he's willing to pay.
Yeah.
And I think that the major kashrus organizations wouldn't have to do it anymore. There was a time when they would let you do it, but I don't think they would anymore.
This was in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all. They just paid us like $10, $15, six of us to just go.
$10? Now you'd have to pay $10 an hour.
Right. I said it was
the same. Okay, now we're going to go to our real topic for the day.
So if you're invited to someone's home.
Yes. You are non-Jews home?
No.
You can buy their bushel lines that are $30,
$50. Do you ask to look in the kitchen to see who's touching the food?
Let me put it this way. If I went to a home and I was concerned that there were issues of non-Jewish help, then that is definitely a kashrus issue. And that's why we come to this class, because people need to be aware that these are issues that come up, of the non-Jewish help doing things. You know, it's very interesting. I once had a situation where I went into a house, someone invited me, wonderful people, firm people. And they had, it was quite clear that they had put food in the oven on Shabbos afternoon, which anyone who has come to my Shabbos class knows, you're just not allowed to do. And what do you do? I'm the rabbi. But on the other hand, they invited me. So I asked, what we did was we didn't eat that food. But, you know, the next month, so lo and behold, what do you know, in the show bulletin comes out, you know, how to reheat your food on Shabbos. And they came afterwards, and, you know, they learned, and they were very interested to know. You know, but there's a lot of things like this. That's why you have a class like this, to know what you can do, what you can't do. Okay, so we have to start really from the beginning. In order to understand really how kashrus works, I'm going to blow your mind. Really, I think I am. Something's gonna surprise you. Okay? So we're going to talk first about a halachic concept called bittul. Bittul means nullification. Okay, and I will tell you, I'm using as a guide this book called Pisrei Halacha, which is written first in Hebrew. It's written by a man named Rabbi Binyamin Forrest. We're going to read parts of it. Remember, like we did with the Shabbos book as well. But it really, it's a very, you'll read it. It's like a law book of, you know, and if, unless you're immersed in the issues, I can't imagine that this would be, how shall we say, bedtime reading. You know, it's very, very involved, very intricate halachas. So, and you'll see exactly where it comes from. So now I have with me today my little bag of tricks. I have... What?
Fire up the grill.
Hamburgers.
So it just so happens...
Beef patties.
Thank you. For those of you watching at home, I'm now placing on my plastic gloves. Okay. It just so happens that three of these beef patties, most of them come from anywhere here? Superior. What? This beef patty comes from Flama Jack, not the kosher aisle. So what would happen if inadvertently, I'm doing this on purpose, so it doesn't count, but what would happen if inadvertently, for some whatever reason, somehow my beef patty from Flama Jack got somehow mixed in with these beef patties? Now, anybody watching, does everybody know which one is which?
No.
Right, you have no idea?
Yeah.
What? Okay? So now I've got five seemingly identical beef patties, right? So I've got at least four good ones. So what's the halacha? Very interesting case, right?
Majority rule.
What?
I wouldn't eat any of them.
You wouldn't eat any of them.
But I guess there is, depending on...
What'd you say?
How much of the whole thing was no good.
How much of the whole thing was... I got one beef patty. Now, it's very important. I'm using a very specific example. Okay, I'll give you another example.
But only if it's by accident, not if it's on purpose.
Wait. We said nothing. We said new topic. I've got... I know. Now, this is real.
I know.
Four that I knew were kosher, and one of them I knew for a fact is not kosher beef. Tyson. Okay? Beef patties. They're identical. You cannot tell the difference one from the other. Right? Trace.
Farmer Jack sells kosher
beef. Right, no, I bought it at the Trace. I didn't buy it. Okay. But, you know, let's say, for example... things get mixed up. I mean, you know, things happen.
A customer picks something from...
Not, God forbid, at Farmer Jack, because nothing ever would happen to Farmer Jack to, you know, make anybody think that these things might happen. But let's take ourselves back not so long ago, when meat wasn't hermetically sealed in packages. When you bought meat, how did it come? How did it come?
In paper.
Good. I've got packages. Right? So it just so happens that I'm checking out of Superior or whatever it is, and I've got a package, and my non-Jewish neighbor's got a package, You know, these things would be able easily get mixed up. And what happens before they had paper? So how would you transport your meat?
Carried it loose.
Yeah, yes, right.
A wheelbarrow.
They had it, right, exactly. How would you identify, is there any way for me to identify among these five beef patties, which is the kosher, which are the four kosher, and which is the one trade?
Smell different?
No.
No.
There's no way to know.
From
cows?
Good. So what do I do? They're all beef. What do I do? What's the halacha? Take a guess.
The rove, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, we're going to show you.
Unless you do it on purpose, like you did.
Right, right.
You can't do it.
Correct.
Right.
Very good. Right.
It's all trace.
All trace. Right. You say all trace?
All
trace.
All trace.
Yeah. You're reading the rules. What?
The majority of it's good, so it must all be good.
All be good. Okay. You think it's good?
I'd say throw the whole thing out and serve nothing.
Throw the whole thing out and serve nothing. That's what most people would say nowadays. So now we're going to learn the halacha. So the same thing to be true. You know, now obviously this never happens in our kitchens, but we're going to see at the end that some things do happen in our kitchens that are similar. I've got here Paskis or Bloomy, as God only knows. You know, jelly beans. Lo and behold, what do you know? What do you know? I've got a tray for jelly beans, right? Don't do it. And I'm not allowed to do it on purpose, as we're going to see at the end, but let's say, oh my God, which of the red ones is kosher and which is not? Because I knew it was red, right? So am I allowed to eat the jelly beans? So first of all, the other ones I for sure could eat. Okay, let's separate. So now I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 red jelly beans, one of which was trafe, and four of which are kosher. Same case. Exactly the same case. What do you say, Aviva?
I say you shouldn't take any of them. I would just
don't touch any of them, right? Because each one, maybe this one is the trafe one.
That's the type of thing I like jelly beans anyway.
Okay, fine. Well, neither do I, but that's another issue entirely. So let's read the sources. What is bittul? What is nullification? Says the Mishnah. Read inside. Let's see. Read inside. Says the Mishnah. Mishnah says, Gid Hanasha. What is Gid Hanasha?
Sciatic nerve.
The sciatic nerve. It's a sinew. It's a gid, right? It's not a nerve. It's a... We're going to see. Hold on. It's a gid. Sinew, I think. That's what they call
it? It's a nerve.
It's a piece of nerve tissue.
That goes to
the sciatic nerve is an actual...
No, the sciatic nerve, but the gid hanasha is a muscle. It's a piece of meat. The muscle around that. Right. Shenidbashel im hagidim. Whoops. So I was cooking up muscle, right? And I accidentally cooked the gid hanasha together with it. Now, what is the gid hanasha? Halachically?
Trafe.
Uh-oh. Right? So here you had a piece of meat from the same animal, and I was cooking things up, and I didn't recognize, I didn't know. And the guy says, where's the gid hanasha? I went, you know, no, sir, I just threw it all in the pot. Oh, whoops. What's the halacha? So the Mishnah says, Bisman shemakiro, if it is recognizable, the no same time, we're going to see if it imparts flavor. And if it imparts flavor, it has the power to trafe up the whole mixture. We eat lav. And if not, if it is not recognizable, kulan asurim, they're all forbidden, v'harotev v'nosein tam. That if let's say it's not recognizable, like my jelly bean, like my meat patty, so then they're all forbidden, and if there's juice, if there's meat, then I have to find out if the piece of gid hanasha had the power in order to impact taste on the mixture, on the sauce. So just to give an example, I'm making meatballs, and I have a gid hanasha meatball, and I throw it in. Right? So would that meatball have the power to impart taste on all of the sauce? So the answer is?
Depends on the percentage.
How much sauce?
Yeah.
Sure. Right, and we're going to see that that ratio is, you know what the ratio is, the required ratio in halacha?
I was going to say, it would depend on how many meatballs you
have. 60 to 1. Right, 1 to 60. Okay, value. That's batel b'shishin. That's the next week's topic. Batel b'shishin. Okay? And the same is true v'chein chaticha shel nevela. The same is true of a nevela. My farmer jack meat. My farmer jack meat is a trafe, I remember. No, it's not trafe. It's a nevela. Nevela is an animal that's killed. We learned that. An animal that's killed not by shchita. That's nevela. Okay? I got nevela.
My mother
would call it
nevela
said we did something. That's what you know. V'chein or a non-kosher fish. If you recognize it, then you pull it out and see if it gets taste. Nimlav, kulan asuris. If not, they're all forbidden. Baharote benotein tam. And the sauce, again, is benotein tam, whether it imparts taste or not. So the Gemara asks a very interesting question. See, if you look at the Gemara in source number 2, so we said that, again, it seems like, right, is it batel, if it imparts taste?
Yes.
What?
It's no good.
If it imparts taste?
Yeah.
What if it doesn't impart taste? So says the Gemara in the following question. Gid hanasa shiniz basel, it's cooking. So the Gemara says, v'liftol biruba. See what the Gemara is? I'm on source number 2. Let it be negated, batel, nullified, biruba, with the majority. That's a question mark. So the Gemara says, beria sa'ani. The Gemara says, a beria, which we're going to learn, is an entity in and of itself. Remember I said last week, about 2 weeks ago, about bugs, or about entities? So the entire Gid Hanasha is a beria. It's a full-fledged sinew, whatever you want to call it. Since it's a whole item in and of itself, it's not batel. It's not nullified. But what if it was an entire... See, what if it was not such an important item? What if it wasn't a beria? Would this item, would this piece of meat be batel, be nullified? The answer is... yes, it would. Halachically, it would be nullified. So you look at, on the right, on the left-hand side, I'll read it for you. These are for the words of the Tosfos. If you look in the Gemara, right, the Gemara, if you see where the Rashi script on the left-hand side, I'm going to read it for you. So but they don't have translations for this stuff, which is, that's where I come on. Okay? Yeah. So, I'm on source number 2 in the middle, source number 2. Okay? She says, Beria Shani, right, since it's an entity in and of itself, the Tosfos says, Va'afilu be'elef lo batel. The LF means it wouldn't be nullified one in a thousand. So remember we talked about bugs, whole like insects. So whole insects, as long as it's whole, it's a beria and it's never batel, never nullified, which is why you can't eat bugs. But if you crush them, you make them into jelly, and then they're not whole anymore, enjoy your strawberry jam. Okay? V'chein, we're going to get into that. V'chein, chaticha ha'ru'uya li'iskabed, lo b'teila. There's a concept, another principle, not just a beria, called the chaticha ha'ru'uya li'iskabed, a significant portion. Let's say you got a side of beef. So if you have a side of beef among 1,000 side of beef, so sides of beef is a really significant portion, and therefore it's not batel, not negated. Okay? Okay. So let's skip down to the fourth line, the beginning of the line, right after the parentheses. The dabar she'eino lo beria, but it's something that is not an entity. My meat patty. It's not an entity, it's a meat patty. V'lo chaticha ru'uya l'hiskabed, and it's not a side of beef, it's not a very important thing. Batel bero. It is nullified in the majority. V'afilu iser midrabanan leka.
So you can eat it.
You can eat it.
If it's by mistake.
If it's by mistake.
Yeah.
So now, but again, I need to blow your mind, right?
Yeah.
I had four, by mistake. I mean, yeah. I did it on purpose.
Yeah.
So since it's on purpose, you can't do it. Right, we're going to see. You're not allowed to do it. Because otherwise, then you could just take tray and say, well, I got two. I got one. Good, great. I got three now. But if you do it by accident, right, go ahead and grill them up and enjoy. Why?
They're not trays.
Right. But I just told you... yes, you do. Right, that's exactly the point. This is a halachic concept. And he says, but, umihu, but, shemalachad gavra haya aser. He says, but, one person shouldn't eat all of them.
Right.
The question becomes, the interesting question becomes...
It's sort of like a firing squad. You don't know who actually killed them.
That's exactly correct. That's exactly right. One person says shouldn't eat all of them. Why?
Because then you know you ate trace meat.
Right. But if I eat one, and then I eat another one, and then I eat another one, and then I give you one. So I can say, each time I ate one, I said, well, which one did I eat? So you can always assume you ate from the majority. This is, by the way, this is actual accepted halachic practice. That's right, Shaki.
And the jelly beans?
Same thing, doesn't matter what it is. What?
If it's by accident.
If it's by accident. I mean, but this never happens, by the way, because we live in a time where everything is itemized and marked. I've never had a shaila about this issue, except I did. I'm going to show you at the end that this does have ramifications in your kitchen. Actual ramifications in your kitchen. Happens all the time. But this never happens. Nobody ever has trace jelly beans lying around the kitchen and by accident it got mixed in. But if it did, let's say you had M&Ms from 1975 and they got mixed in here with your huge bucket of M&Ms. That's exactly what it is. Each one is an individual. You cannot eat the whole bucket of M&Ms at one sitting anyway because you have other problems. But this principle of batel v'rov, nullified in the majority, applies. So now the question is, can you eat them all at once or not? So the Tosfos we just learned said you may not eat them all at once. Let's look at the Rush. The Rush.
Yeah. How do you determine what's a significant entity? Why?
A davar really skabet. So the halachic parameters of what a davar really skabet is. Shulchan Aruch talks about that.
Okay.
And let's just assume that our meat patty is not one. Is not
okay,
that.
Gotcha.
Okay. Fine.
Okay.
So now we look at the Rush. So now I just want to give you. I want to give you a sort of understanding, historical perspective of what's going on. Okay. These laws. Right. We're talking about. This is a d'oraisa law. As we're going to see in a minute, where this law came from. So these laws were given down to the rabbis and transmitted in the oral Torah. Right? This law of Bitul Berov is a din d'oraisa. Okay, God decreed that in Judaism things are following the majority. Right, the rule follows the majority, as we'll see. Now I'll show it to you right now. Okay, turn to page 2. Okay. Source number 5. I'm skipping a little bit, but it's important to see. Source number 5. See source number 5 in the box?
Shmos,
chapter 23 on the Midrash. Says the Torah, Lo tisa se mashav. You may not... you must not accept an unauthentic report. Al tasha yadcha im rash sovios eid chamas. Do not collaborate with a wicked person as a corrupt witness for him. That Lo tia acharei rabim Leraos, you must not follow the majority to do evil. This is learned out, by the way, it's talking about courts. So therefore, if you're going through the Gemara learns out, if you're going to execute somebody, you can't execute on a one-person majority. It has to be more than one person. Okay? Velo ta'ane'al riv, litos acharei rabim lahatos. You must not follow the majority. You may not respond to the dispute according to the majority opinion so as to pervert justice. Okay? So, but let's take the last three words. The last three words say, Acharei Rabim Lahatos. Okay, the last three words, if we take them interestingly, out of context, admittedly out of context, the Rabbanan at a Mesora, they had an accepted tradition that was passed down in the Torah Shabbat Peh, in the oral tradition, from time and generation to generation, that you take these last three words, Acharei Rabim Lahatos, okay? If you look at the Midrash on the right hand side, I'm going to show you two examples of the Midrash on this source. So God said to Moshe when they were at Mount Sinai to prepare themselves. Tani b'mechilta. We learned in the Midrash, Hayom hazeh revi'i lachodesh, right? That day was the fourth day of Sivan. This is, by the way, totally separate issue. Umachar yom chamishi l'shabbos, and the next day was the fifth day. Uvaskamas yom shishi vana mizbeach tachasahar. Okay? And on the sixth day, now Moshe Rabbeinu built an altar on the bottom of the mountain. V'lav davka, v'lo kaimalan hachi. It's not true, we don't hold like him. V'masnisa yechidahi, v'aliba d'Rabbi Yossi, he says. That opinion that God spoke to Moses on a Wednesday, that's an individual of one opinion. Upligi rabbanon ale. And the rabbis argue with Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi is an individual, and the rabbis were the majority. The kaimalan, and this is an important word, and you can underline those words if you're so interested. Yachid v'rabim, right? If there's an individual and there are many, halacha kirabim. The halacha is like the majority, follows the majority. Dichshiv, as it is written, one of the next three words, acharei rabim lahatos. You see how they took those three words out of context in the verse? Out of context, but the tradition teaches us that the halacha follows the majority.
Okay.
By the way, these are the underpinnings of democracy.
Okay.
Right? If three judges say guilty, and two judges say not guilty, or vice versa, who do you follow?
Three.
How could you follow the majority? Who are you to follow the majority? Why shouldn't we always require a unanimous opinion?
Where do you want to learn, Charlie?
Because I'll never get it. I know what you're thinking. Right. What?
Where do you want to learn?
No, that's okay. I'll come back and watch the last three lines in that Negro. The last three lines. Why shouldn't you always... Let me finish. And why shouldn't you always follow the majority? Whoever had that concept, one could easily have come to the opinion that if anyone thinks the guy's not guilty, we should always be concerned for the minority opinion. But therefore, the Torah comes along and teaches us that it doesn't work that way. That you follow the majority and give it precedence over the minority. Acharei Rabin Mahatos. And this is, by the way, your underpinnings for democracy.
Except in the death case in Sanhedrin, if they were unanimous.
Right. Now, let's look at the next piece in the Midrash. The Yalkut Shimoni in the Torah, Parshas Vayikra. So the Gemara says, this our precisely exact case. Says the Gemara, Minola HaMilsa, how do we know the thing? The honor Rabban, and the rabbi said, Zil Basa Ruba, follow the majority. Minolan, how do we know it? Dechiv, as it is written, Achare Rabin Lahato. So not only do we say follow the majority if people are voting on a specific issue, we also follow the majority of jelly beans. Achare Rabin Lahato. This is an accepted halachic principle that was transmitted from the Rabbanit in the times of the Talmud all the way down. It's not even mentioned, need to be mentioned in the Gemara per se, because everybody knew it. That's when the Gemara says, turn back to page 1 for a second. See in source number 2. See in that very short piece of Gemara, very short. The Gemara says, Gira Nashani Special, Vilibatel, Beruba, how come, in our case, of my meat patties, why is the Gira Nashani not negated, not nullified by majority? They knew because there was a principle of majority rules. Okay? So the Gemara says, Beria Shiny, because this is a Beria, it's a Gid, it's a whole sinew. But if it was less than a sinew, if it was just a meat patty, good. But the Gemara does not say, by the way, well then, can I eat them all? Can you eat them all at the same time? Do I have to leave one over? Do I have to throw one away? Can different people eat them all? The Gemara does not say that. Okay, and now we're in the times of the Talmud. The Talmud was codified, closed in the year 70 in the Common Era. Okay. How do you answer that question? So along came a group of rabbis called the Rishonim. The Rishonim, really the period of the Gaonic period for a couple of hundred years, 400 or 500 years, and then there was a period of what we would call halachic darkness, we'll say. Until the emergence of the Rif and the Rambam. The Rif was really one of the first Rishonim, and that period lasted from about 1,000 all the way till the end of the to the codification of the Shulchan Aruch of the Rabbi Yosef Karo. Now, Rabbi Yosef Karo was really one of the last Rishonim. And these Rishonim, they had great debates about these issues. You understand? The Gemara says, Rove, I got it. But what about all the tangential issues? How many jelly beans can I eat? Who can eat them? That's why you have Rishonim. So we're going to see that there's going to be a four-way machlokes about this particular issue. A four-way machlokes about how it's supposed to be eaten. So now, what did the Baalei Tosfos say? The Tosfos said, can one person eat them all? No. As long as more than one person eats them all, then each time you're eating them, you ate the majority. And that's okay. Along comes the Rush, right? The Baalei Tosfos, by the way, just so you know, they lived primarily in France, in Provence, and in France, some in England, during the Middle Ages, okay? The Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel lived, I don't remember exactly the time, the same time, it was known as the Rush. Remember when he lived, Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel? 1200s, that sounds about right. So around the time of the Tosafos, and he also was a Rishon, so he said something different. He said, how does this work? One is nullified with the other. So let's look at the Rush, bottom of page 1. He says, Medafka gid v'chaticha. That's only, it's an important piece. Aval davar she'ein beria, like the Tosfos, but something that is not an entity, a bug, an animal, a whole item. V'lo chaticha ro'yo l'iskabe, it's not a very significant piece. Batel berov. No, that's the halacha. V'afilu isa d'rabbanan leka, and there is not even a rabbinic prohibition. There's none in isa d'rabbanan, k'demash mahacha. The yira, this is where it starts getting interesting, right before the break. Yira, I think, shemutu l'achlan ke'echad. I think you can eat them all at one time. Says the Rush, you want to take these 5 meat patties, make a quintuple pounder, and down them all at one time? Go for it.
One person.
Cholesterol City, USA.
Ask the question.
During prayer.
Well, you already know one of them is
faith.
One of them is faith.
You know one of them is faith.
So, by the way, but according to Tosfos, it didn't bother you a minute ago. You ate four and I ate one, it's okay?
No, one of us ate three.
Tosfos said it's mutter, totally permitted.
Because you don't know who's doing it.
No, it each one, you can assume that each one came from the majority. The rest says, eat them all at one time, be my guest. Why? He'll explain to you. Read what he says.
What if you eat four,
yeah,
and there's one left over, the other person eats one?
Yeah.
That person is not eating from the majority. That person is eating from the
majority. But he knows that he's eating from when there were five. He's eating five out of five, one out of the five where the majority was.
But if there were
two. By the way, it's just two and one's two. It's only if there are three.
Right.
Three is okay. If there's two, there's no majority. No row. Yes.
Thanksgiving of 1949. I went to Rabbi Vogelerner,
okay,
may he rest in peace, to ask a shiloh. The butcher sold me supposedly a kosher turkey.
Okay.
My husband was Alva Sholem, was a veterinarian. When he saw the turkey, he said to me, "This turkey is trafe." He said, "It's a broken leg."
Ah.
So I said, "No, maybe the butcher broke it."
Right.
He said to me, and my husband could care less about kashrut.
Uh-huh. I remember he was a veterinarian. I knew that, actually. Yeah.
Well, and so he said to me, take it to a rabbi and ask a shiloh.
What did Rabbi Vogelerner say? You know, if you would have brought that turkey to me, you know what I would have said?
Eat it.
No, God, no. I don't know. We don't have training in that anymore.
Rabbi Vogelerner.
We discussed this.
Yeah. Rabbi Vogelerner,
who ultimately became the secretary of the Knesset, said to me, do you have something else to cook?
He didn't think it was kosher. Did he look at it?
Yes, he did. And unfortunately, he was sick when I went there to his house. First he asked me who...
No, come on, I got to go on. So
who I was and who my parents were.
Interesting.
And how come I came to ask a shiloh? And then I explained the situation to him.
He said, do you have anything else to cook?
Yeah,
and you said...
I said to him, my husband says it's trade.
Yeah.
He said, what does your husband do for a living?
Yeah.
I said, he's a veterinarian. He's an animal doctor. He said, if you have something else to cook...
Do that,
then
Antonio.
Take it back to the butcher... But if you have nothing else to cook,
interesting.
And I was pregnant, incidentally, 8 months pregnant, and he said, if you have nothing else to cook, you can cook the turkey, you and your husband can eat it, you can't give it to anybody else.
Huh. All right, well, we'll have to discuss that at a later date.
And so I remember that.
Is that what you did?
I said to the mother, we don't have to eat turkey.
Okay, good for you. So how does it work? Let's look at the bottom of page number one. He says, how does it work? The rest explains. I'm skipping a lot because I'm trying to, you know, the hard part of these classes is to try to really boil it down to the nitty-gritty. Because there are, as you can imagine, there are so many possible permutations and details that I'm leaving out. It really is the most challenging part. It's very important. It's dry. You notice the examples. They're separate entities. It's dry. Why does it have to be dry? Because if it was wet, if it was sauce, you'd have taste. Then you're in totally, total another issue. Afilu midrabanan batel. Okay? It's even negated midrabanan, meaning you would say, oh, okay, from the Torah it's okay, but the rabbi said no good, right? Because the rabbi's always said no good, right? No. The rabbi, this case, didn't even say it's so good. Delomi shum sveka sharminam, right? Okay? It's not because you're doubt. You know, you could say, well, each one, I don't know if it's the right one. Dafilu yachil lechada chada. Even if you only ate it one by one, leka elechada sveka. There's only one doubt. Let's say I eat these one at a time. If I eat them one at a time, right? The question is this the treif one or not? There's always that question. Is this the treif one or not? There's only one question. And it's a dilaisha, by the way. Is this treif, Torah treif, or not? So what is the halacha in Safek d'oraisa? The chumrah, right? The rule is, anytime you have a case of Safek of doubt, if it's a Torah law, we're stringent. If it's a rabbinic law, we're lenient. He says, "Useka the oraisa l'chumra." So you should really not be able to eat any of them. So how does it work? Ella yishum digzeras hakasavu. It's a gzeres hakasev. What does gzeres hakasev mean? How would you translate gzeres hakasev? It is a decree of the Torah. That what? Yechid, as it is written, acharei rabim lahatos. See those three words that we learned out already? Acharei rabim lahatos. You follow the majority. Hilkach, therefore, chad bitrei batel. One into two is negated, is batel. The nefach ha'isr lihios heter. The prohibited transforms into the permitted. He said to me, "Umutar la'achlan afilu kulan ke'echas," and you may eat them. So you'll say, "I knew it was going to get you. I knew." Four, says the Rush. You see here four kosher and one treif, and you don't know which one it is. No, the Torah says all five are kosher.
Okay.
Nefach ha'isr liyot heter.
That's only if it's beef.
They're all the same. They have to be the same and unrecognizable.
Okay, but I'm saying if one were pork, and
doesn't matter. I mean, could you taste it?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it have to be the same and unrecognizable. They have to be the same, right? Pork you could recognize.
I think
they're
kind of the
other way. Right, look here. So I've got five jelly beans. You cannot tell, right? One is a gelatin jelly bean, and one is, you know, animal fat, whatever you want to call it, and the other four are blueies. Right? It doesn't matter. Well, now, says the Rush, you're looking at five kosher jelly beans.
What if you can taste it when you're eating it?
Ah, then you'd have to ask a non-Jew to taste it. If it was taste, if you could discern...
No, I mean, like that.
Oh, I'm eating it and I'm saying, oh, this is the treif one?
Yeah.
They're beef. How would you tell? It's beef.
Well, now you buy me, it's already passed.
Beef is beef.
No, but jelly beans are not jelly beans. There's a big difference between...
You know, okay, you know what I'm saying? Use my example. Some, you know, you could have American cheese that's processed, it doesn't, they all taste the same, it's all garbage, right? One is kosher and one is not kosher, and they got mixed together. Any type of items that are separate items that are interchangeable, that are not recognizable, it could happen. Now, by the way, just because of, we should realize how prevalent the problem this was and how little of a problem it is today for one simple reason: packaging. In today's day and age, everything comes with a package. Not only is it packaged, every fruit has a sticker on it. Right? It's individually wrapped and packaged. So again, I say, this Shaila never comes up except we're going to see in a different case. Okay, we'll see. It does come up in our kitchens all the time.
Other than pork, I don't know what venison or any of those, are they distinguishable?
Let's assume that they are. It's separate types of meat. I'm talking about on... You know, you can't differentiate. And by the way, this would happen all the time, because every butcher, a real butcher, not the butchers that we have where you get the side of beef already kashered from Rubashkin and you just have to slice it up. A real butcher, what they do, they took the cow and they cut it up. Part of the cow was kosher and part of the cow wasn't kosher. Why do you think the Mishnah talked about this?
But the rear is kosher if they don't have a trigger.
Well, no, parts of it are not. The Gina Nasha is not kosher.
They cut out that,
but it's a piece of meat. What does it look like?
No,
it looks like a piece of meat.
There's a vein there.
But it looks like a piece. Let's say you took the vein. No, they're not just the veins. The actual ghee, the actual piece of meat itself, looks like a piece of meat. So you had treif and kosher sitting on the same counter all the time. So these were questions that the rabbis of 1,000 years ago dealt with all the time. Oh my God, I don't know which one is the treif one.
It wasn't ancient history that they actually cut them apart. This was the case.
Right.
20 years ago.
But they cut the animals apart. Right, yeah, 100%. So this is not a new thing. If you ever go to a kosher butcher nowadays, if you go to the warehouse by a slaughterhouse, so you've got kosher and treif all over the place. Because every slaughterhouse has treif animals. There's just no way around it. So they mark them. Now let's be honest, they mark them. Once they start cutting things up, I mean, it's very hard to keep track. A piece of meat is a piece of meat. It's very hard. So that these halachas are real occurrences. They just don't happen in front of us. They don't happen in our kitchens because we don't bring these things into our kitchens. We're going to skip from. I will tell you the other things.
If it's at least a 1 and 2 mixture.
At least a 1 and 2, as opposed to what?
As opposed to 50-50.
Oh, excellent question. Excellent question. What if you had 7 to 6?
Seven. Well, you'll have to help.
Seven kosher to six.
I'm going to say it's not kosher.
It's a machlokes. It's a debate. It's a debate among the Achronim.
Okay.
Among the Achronim are the rabbis that came afterwards, because the Rishonim couldn't account for everything. So the Achronim discussed exactly that issue. What if you don't have 2-to-1, a 2-to-1, meaning if it's 70-30, everybody agrees a 2-to-1 majority. Mm-hmm. But if it's less than a 2-to-1 majority, then you have that the debate issue. Okay, if you look, I just want to show you in order to understand. Okay, page 3 is the Shulchan Aruch. So I just want you to know, now you know that I'm a real rabbi, because when you study for the rabbinate, you have to learn your Hodea. That is part of the, around the world, everybody knows in order to get Shmicha, you have to learn these halachos, pretty much. You have to learn Tarovesh, mixtures. You have to learn Basa B'chalav, you have to learn Melicha. These are the bread and butter of the rabbinate. Why is this the bread and butter of the rabbinate? That's what they assume. They're the questions. But nowadays, they probably should teach you how to do a funeral. But that's another issue entirely. Okay, so you can see, I photocopied for you from my Shulchan Aruch. These are my, holy mackerel, I haven't seen these in ages. These are my notes for my test. Right, so you can, these are, you know.
Just before you can put down your laptop.
Oh my goodness, wow. You know.
So you cheated on the test.
No, God no. I had to memorize this, okay? Mm-hmm. Not that I remember it. Nowadays I would just say, hold on a minute, I'll call you back, I've got to look it up.
Look at my concordance.
There's no shame in looking things up, if you know what I'm saying. Oh, I have a test here.
If you know where to look them up.
Wow.
How'd you do?
I passed. And what can I tell you? So you'll see, I'm just showing you, like, you know, in the Shulchan Aruch, so you're studying it. You're studying it, you're underlining, you're copying, and you can see that I actually learned it, hopefully, at one point. Okay? So you look at the Shulchan Aruch, and I'm reading for you, I just want to show you, page 2 and 3 open in front of you, just so you understand. Okay? The Rishonim debated throughout these hundreds of years of literature, right? The writings are going on. Most of the Rishonim were commenting on the Gemara. Along came a man named Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rabbi Yosef Karo is the author of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, we call it the code of Jewish law, right? Basically, normative halacha follows the Shulchan Aruch almost always. Pretty much almost always. Always, I would say. But if you want to understand why he writes something in the Shulchan Aruch, he also wrote another book. He called it the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef. Okay, if you look at the Beis Yosef, look at page 2, right? You see where it says, source 4, Beis Yosef Yoredea? This is one short paragraph describing, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch on page 3 is just the stuff on the inside. It's a code. It's a law code. But in order to understand why he says what he says, you have to look in the Beis Yosef. And it's very clear. It tells you exactly why he says what he says. So we learn the Rush, and we learn the Tosfos. Okay, the Tosfos says one person can't eat it, and the Rush said one person can eat it all at once. Okay, the Rashba, who much of these halachas are based on, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, the Rashba lived in Spain, and he wrote one of the authoritative works on kashrus called the Torah Habayis, the Torah Habayit. He writes that one person can eat it, but you shouldn't eat it all at once. Each time you can eat it, one piece at a time. You can't eat it all at once, because if you eat it all at once, then you know one of them is straight. But if you eat it one at a time, that as long as you're taking one from the majority, each one you take again is from the majority. Okay, so there you can see there are different permutations of this halacha. So now let's see source number 6. Now I'm not going to read you the Beis Yosef. I'm sorry, I don't have time. It's very interesting. But we're going to see source number 6. And if we had read the Beis Yosef, you would see that the Beis Yosef is describing to you all the things you're going to see in the codes. Says the halacha. This is in the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, I'm not making this up. It's a pretty wacky halacha, I must say. Very surprising, right? To say the least. Din, you'd still throw it away. Yeah. I'm going to get to that in a second. Din yavish b'yavish nis'arev. Says the Shulchan Aruch, chaticha she'ena b'ruyu l'sgar. Remember, a piece that's not a major piece. Shenis'arva ba'acheros, that mixed in with others. Min b'mina, right? Min b'mina means one species in its own species, right? A hamburger patty in a hamburger patty. A jelly bean in jelly beans. Yavish b'yavish. They're all dry. Okay? These are all dry in our cases. The Hainu Shein or Nizlal, it did not get swallowed up. The Ha'iser Ome Ba'atmo, right? I can see, I have one straight jelly bean here. So each one stands on its own. Ela Shinish Are, but it's mixed in. The Eno Makiro. And you don't see it, right? We've got this right in front of us. Skip to the end of the line. Chad betray batil. It's nullified, one into two. Umutar le'achlam adam echad. One person can eat them all. Kol achas bifnei atzma. Just as long as I'm taking one by one, this jelly bean, next jelly bean, next jelly bean, I can eat each one. One person can eat each one. So the normative first opinion of Shulchan Aruch follows, like I told you, the Rashba. Fine. Aval lo yochal shlostam yachad. But shouldn't eat them all at the same time. Don't eat all three jelly beans together. Miyeshmi, that's going to give you another opinion. There's another opinion that says that one person can't eat them all, even one after the other. What opinion is that? Anybody remember? Which opinion we saw that forbade you to eat all of them one after the other? Tosfos. Very good. Skip down, follow the arrow, just because I didn't want to put a whole other page on there. Haga, the Ramah adds, V'chein yesh lino l'chadchila. See where I am? See to follow the arrow down, right at the bottom there? Just because I only photocopied that small piece. That's how you should practice lechachila. Lechachila, this is the halachic practice. Right? One person can eat them, one person should eat them, even one after the other, rather, two people can eat them all. That's the halacha. V'yesh machmirin, some are even machmir, lahashlich echad, obite in the goy. Give one of them to a guy. Ve'enu ella, it literally says, ve'enu ella chumra bi'alma. How many of us would just do a chumra bi'alma? What's a chumra bi'alma?
Throw
them
all away?
No. That's not, not throw them all away. Throw one away. Throwing one away is just a chumra. Lechad chila, you can have four and I have one. Lechad chila, a priori. No problem whatsoever. You're not being napier, you're not following the leniency, you're not being too modern. That's the halacha. That's the normative halacha. So now, what happens if Harry Lurch says, no way, I'm throwing them all away. Right? So, if you look down, see where it says on the bottom of that page, can I be machmir? Strict? Right? So it's interesting. Most opinions say no.
I have to eat it.
Yes. Why? Why? Because if you are saying, I don't want to touch that, what are you saying? You're saying, not just that, I don't believe the Torah law. You're saying that I don't accept the principle of bittul. I don't accept it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So look at the bottom line. He says, okay, look at the second bottom line. Someone who wants to be more machmir than Amorai than the rabbis in the Gemara. You want to be more machmir than the rabbis in the Gemara? Let's say something's negated, 1 in 60. You say, no, I'm throwing it away. A drop of milk thrown in my chalet, throw the whole thing away. I don't want any milk in my chalet. It's batel, it's negated. Habikamo apikarsus. That's apikorsis. What's apikorsis? That's heresy.
Heretic.
The yatsaschar behafsedo. His frumkite, nobody wants that frumkite. You have to eat it? Yeah. You don't have to eat it if you don't want the hamburger. But if you say, I'm not eating as it seems trafe to me, no. This is the Torah law. No.
It's kosher.
That's what the rabbi told me. Well, different case.
What
about? Do you understand what I'm saying? Not only that, you have to eat it.
Is that why?
Because you can't say, I want to throw one away. One of them is straight. One of them is not straight.
Is that why?
You can't eat them all at once. And let's say, by the way, you cooked them all together. Mm-hmm. The Ramah says, if you cooked them all together, you can rely on the opinion of the Rush. That the usher became with them, and the whole thing is kosher. Because that's the principle of bittul of the roast.
Boil three eggs together.
Unless you knew which one it was.
In case one.
So, by the way, if you look at page 4, this is Rabbi Force. Rabbi Force writes it all. You can now read it in English, and you'll understand it. I'm not going to read it now, but you can read it in English if you want to, and you'll understand it, hopefully, a lot better than you would have otherwise. See, I said to you before I started, I said at the very beginning, I'm going to show you a case where it happens in your kitchen every day. This happens a lot. I've actually gotten calls about this. Okay? Oh my God, what did I do? I accidentally used this to stir, this is my fleshik, right? I accidentally used it to stir my milchik, God only knows what, right? So what did I do? I put it on the top of the window, so like everybody does. And you say, okay, I'll kasher the next time I do kashering. 6 months later, it's going to be still sitting there, but I'll kasher it. Fine, very good. Your husband comes home. she's a silverware, you know, standing over there. He says, oh, I'll be a good husband. He washes it, dries it like a good husband, puts it away. Okay. Which one was it?
Eeny, meeny.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. What's the difference between this case and this case? The answer is?
Nothing.
Nothing. Look at the shulchan. Page 3 in the gray box.
Even if it's warm, cold, or too hot?
This was, you traced it up. Your mom has traced it. Totally. You stirred warm milk with it. You totally tricked. Me, klish, and nesar, bablias, iser. A fleshing utensil that became subsumed, sublimated with blias, iser. With the taste of prohibition. Shinish arev v'achem, it got mixed in with others. The eino nikar, and it's not, you can't tell which one it is. What's the next two words? Batel perov. It's negated with the majority. Now, by the way, what the later post can say is you should definitely let them wait, we should wait 24 hours to use any of them, as we're going to see why. Right? And some say maybe you should kasher one of them. Why? Because remember, the chumra position was you threw away one of the bipeds. So I would say, I would probably tell you to follow the more stringent opinion, you kasher one of them. What are the odds, by the way, of your 10 spoons, there's 10 forks? What are your odds?
1 in 10.
But that's the point. Then you never know, you know for certain, you never know for certain that one of them is a game. This happens all the time. And by the way, you don't have to. You don't have to throw it away. So let's say you did it with your Corel that can't be kashered, and then you put it back in, you don't know which one it was. Call the rabbi, what does the rabbi say? You couldn't have done a lechachila, but lucky you. Batel berov. Batel berov. That is the halacha. And if you say, rabbi, I'm throwing it away anyways, I would say, don't. That's the halacha. Accept.
You know, with the